History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that really need to be heard, and we're going to get some of those today. Our mission, of course, to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Oceanside, California, with 95-and-a-half-year-old Sid Zimmon, Marine Corps veteran of World War II. And you'd know that if you drove down his street because the flag is flying right outside. One of those Semper Fi guys. But I don't know if that's what you were thinking about growing up in upstate New York or in Michigan. Tell me about your childhood, Sid, and how your parents ended up in America, because that's quite a story in itself.
Yes. Jewish people that lived in Europe could not own should not own property because they didn't know what was coming next. There was always a degree of anti-Semitism. And they were located in Lithuania, southern part of Lithuania, near Poland, in order to make a living. My grandmother, being quite a business lady, would arrange to buy fruit when in season, or send my father to pick up fish to bring back and sell. And my father claimed that the reason he was so short is because he carried these big barrels of fish over on his shoulder. But he was married quite young, probably about 16. My eldest sister, she was 6 months old when the Russians came to conscript Jewish boys to work in the stables. And once there, that was the end of your social life. I mean, you were there for the duration. And so, as many others did, they were able to get, for example, one of his brothers gave him the information to arrange transportation to Ellis Island. They located in areas where other Jewish people were and some relatives as well. And in those days, they had push carts. They didn't have restaurants as we know of them. But the push carts, you'd have vendors of fruit, vendors of vegetables, and so forth. The idea was to get a job, make enough money as soon as possible, and get his wife and child back to the States. Unfortunately, the war broke out.
When you say the war, we're used to on this program talking about World War II. You're talking about World War I.
So obviously, the movement was curtailed by anyone leaving Europe to come to the United States. He went into the Army and there got his citizenship and all, and served there very well. And it was 6.5 years before, while looking assiduously for his wife and child, finally, they found them, the Red Cross found them in a place where they had indigent children. And so while at some points my mother would spend the night in synagogues where it was fairly safe, a young woman, you know, exposed to the entire countryside. But when she found that job, she was cook, baker, and clean up, whatever it was. But that helped save her life and gave her nutrition that she needed and safety, which is most important. It was 6.5 years before the Red Cross found my mother and my eldest sister, and they arranged transportation back. So they were reunited when my eldest sister was 7 years old.
Well, and, you know, not to be master of the obvious, but if they hadn't been reunited, you would never have been born.
Obviously.
And that's quite an amazing story, isn't it? That here's your father, not knowing if he's ever going to see her again or even where she is, can't get a hold of her or anything. I mean, it's almost miraculous that she made it here.
Yes, and my father came here. You know, the type of work that he was doing in Lithuania was very, very far removed from what employment he acquired. He wasn't a tradesman. He didn't work with his hands, and yet he went into a luggage goods factory making suitcases. And throughout his entire life, and he became an upholsterer, but he had the ingenuity to perceive and to perfect what had to be done as a craftsman for that particular thing. He gained employment, fortunately, and the Depression set in. And what you try to do is find some place where you can make a decent living. And so they communicated with other relatives. And most of the other siblings of my mother were located in Rochester, New York. And so they eventually moved there for a number of years, and he opened a leather goods repair facility. And then the touring car started. And I don't know if you're familiar with isinglass, but it's like a heavy celluloid, and the sun played havoc with it. And so that was one of the things he replaced. And then convertibles came along, and he adapted without asking anyone. He had the ability to perceive what was required and did masterfully well with it.
And what about you? What are those things you remember about your childhood in the 20s and 30s?
Well, I must say that being the number one son, there is a, whether you like it or not, there's a certain prestige that goes with it. And to this day, I'm a little resentful of the fact that they bought me a bicycle, beautiful little bike, and they bought me a sled in the wintertime. And they did something for me, whether it was customary for the eldest son, who may be able to, in their elderly age, help them assist in living. I don't know what it is, but number one son usually had a certain prestige. But thinking about it now, I sort of resented that because I didn't need to be treated specially. But one incident occurred that was sort of devastating, and I probably was only about 6-7 years old. My front teeth had come in normally, and was a big area in the front part of the building in Rochester, New York. It was luggage on display and for sale. And in the back is where my father used to do the repair work and as necessary. And we were playing some kind of a game. And in that large area, there was a big door with great big hinges that was in line with the floor. And in order to get to the basement, you just lifted it up. I had my little bike parked there. And stupidly, going after the ball or whatever we were kicking around, I tripped and broke 3/4 of my incisor. And when I went into the Marine Corps, the thing that worried me the most was having that impairment. And so when I finished high school, which was a good idea, but the war started in December, and I finished high school in January and got a job at a place called in downtown Detroit. We were living in Detroit at the time. And again, moving to find some place to make a living. And Peter Apparel in uniform. The Lone Ranger, the original Lone Ranger, I remember he was 6'6". He came in there by these jodhpurs. But I made a few bucks and found a dentist who could replace the tooth. Oh, by that time, the second tooth, the incisor, had moved over. But anyway, I was taken care of. Now, to jump forward a little bit, since I'm talking about the disaster there, when I was in boot camp, at one point, they marched us out in the boondocks, and in MCRD, Recruit Depot, San Diego, at that time, from the parade ground all the way to the harbor was nothing but sand. So they marched us out into the sand. The drill instructor brings out boxing gloves. Uh-oh. And I'm lucky enough to be selected, put on the gloves. Then they got one guy, and they no sooner got the gloves on him, all I could think of was, my God, if he hits me and breaks that bridge, I'll be devastated. And I attacked him, the poor soul. He was bleeding badly, and they stopped the fight. There was one incident that occurred to go back a little bit. Those who enlisted east of the Mississippi were usually sent to Parris Island. I was very fortunate, having heard that they have a lot of sand fleas and stuff there. They were overloaded. And so they decided to take our group, put us on a train, and transport us to San Diego, MCRD. Well, a couple of things I remember very vividly. There was a coal-fired engines in those days, and I couldn't get the window down. And some of these little clinkers, you know, that were blowing back and coming in, and most of the trip I was trying to prevent all these things from coming in on top of me. The other thing I remember is looking out somewhere in the Midwest, for miles and miles, in every direction, there were two roads. and it was a stop sign. I couldn't believe that they would do that, because you could see the cars coming for miles. And while they would have, and so I, in the little memoir that I wrote, you know, unchallenged stop sign.
Well, another thing you write in your memoirs is about December 7th, 1941, and where you were when you heard what happened at Pearl Harbor. But I want to go back a little further, because you talk about being a boy, and I can tell how sharp your memory is. So I'm wondering if you have a memory of that little boy having ambitions or dreams or ideas. Hey, someday when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do.
Today, there are so many more choices. Education in those days was simple. A little bit of science, a little bit of the other math and stuff. Nothing like the educational system today. Not that there was anything wrong with it. And, of course, further education. We didn't have the devices that you have today, which I have never figured out and don't like. way beyond my pay grade. And just to digress for just a moment, people ask me if I have a laptop, a computer. I said, no, I live alone and don't have a three-year-old to show me how to use it. and I will not even attempt to learn that device, because, and little three-year-olds embarrass me by using the little fingers like crazy, but no, it's beyond my pay grade. I'm really very, very simple. Maybe that's how one of the reasons for longevity. You know, you're not burning yourself out, you might say, with all the entertainment. There are a lot of women here, you know. I lost my wife, unfortunately, in 2000. And there are a great many single women here that would love to be wined and dined. But I live a very simple life, and don't go out with gamblers, because I don't gamble. I did smoke for maybe a few months or maybe a year, but it was ridiculous, you know. I stopped that. And I never once in my whole life thought of any kind of drugs. So people make their own choices, sometimes badly.
Well, and another thing that comes to mind with regard to your childhood, in reading your memoirs, you have several references to your Jewish faith, including trying to keep kosher in the military, which obviously wasn't very easy. But I get the sense that that was a big part of your life from a tender age, that in your family that was pretty significant. Am I reading that right?
Oh, of course. You know, since my parents prepared the food that was ethically correct, and I didn't go out the way the kids do today, you know, to gobble up hot dogs here and there. You know, we didn't have those facilities. So it was really simple to just go along with the flow. I remember one time, I think they served a pork chop. I managed to cut everything out but one little teensy piece of meat and said, well, I'll try it. But, you know, there were substitutes. I remember in Munda, we had the mess hall up on a hill, and things were pretty quiet, and you could tell when the meal was approaching because you could hear the aluminum mess gear clinking behind the bushes. In Munda, they served a lot of mutton because they have so many sheep in Australia. And I don't know, lamb, I guess, is not too bad, but mutton, even the odor of mutton was not to my liking. So they did have peanut butter in big gallon cans. Now, it's not like Jif today or Skippy. This was pretty hard, not too oily. But I existed, obviously, because I'm here today.
Yeah. Well, what about December 7th, 1941. Where were you, and how did you find out what had happened?
I remember it was a Sunday. I was just leaving a little theater. Don't remember what I watched, but the news came out at that point that we had been attacked. And obviously, I knew that I would be going into the Marine Corps if they accepted me. I don't ridicule or cast any aspersions on any other service personnel. The Coast Guard are magnificent, and they each have their jobs, obviously. But I never gave it a thought. But I went straight to the recruiting depot in the Marine Corps, and I didn't like the idea of reserve, and I enlisted as a regular for 4 years.
What was it about the Marine Corps that told you that's what I want to be part of?
Well, you know, they had good publicity, but that wasn't the main factor. I like uniqueness. I like precision. All those things that Marines have attributed to them, I took for granted. And so there was just second choice. You know, if they had turned me down, I don't know what I would have done. But no, they accepted me and told me I could go home and pack a couple little things and be back at a certain time. And that was the last meal that I had with my mother and father before I came back.
Now, we're going to end up hearing about your love affair with the SBD. There's a model of an SBD, Dauntless Dive Bomber, right here. There's pictures of you in SBDs everywhere, even recently. This is almost an annual thing for you to go sit in that rear-facing gunner seat and go for a ride. But the story of how you ended up in a Marine air wing as a Marine aviator is an interesting story, too. Sounds like it was a bit of chance or luck, or was somebody pulling those strings? How does that story go?
They had a whole series of dots and dashes because Morse code in those days was a popular communication device. And if you could distinguish between a dot and a dash accurately, you were eligible. And so the instructor said, put an A or a G in the upper right-hand corner of the paper that you're going to submit. Being a little stupid, I didn't know which was which. They didn't explain it. And it was a Marine instructor passing by. I asked him what the difference was. He never told me, but he told me to put down an A. Now, he made the decision for me because Barney Ross, who preceded me, a very outstanding boxer, had three titles in the lighter weights. He preceded me at MCRD. Barney Ross was in the platoon, about three platoons ahead of us, and he went on to Guadalcanal with a radio on his back. However, those who chose A, or aerial, meant that we were sent after we finished boot camp. Of course, this took place the seventh week. In those days, we only had 7 weeks of boot camp because they were turning us out, you know, a little bit on the quick side. Now it's about 13 weeks. They sent us to Jacksonville, Florida, where the Navy had a radio instructional facility, and there was a lieutenant commander probably who was in charge. Now, not being too bright, I would ask a lot of questions, and the answer that he gave every time was, that's a phenomenon. So I never really got a direct answer from him. And it's surprising that of the number in that class of perhaps 40 or 50, I graduated top in my class. I couldn't believe that. And the top third were made corporals. I never was a PFC. Made me corporal. And the other third of the group went down to Hollywood, Florida. And so the liberty they had was pretty nice with Miami so close. And they sent me in charge of the group to Yellowwater, Florida. And the first thing I remember and always will remember, at the gunnery school in Yellowwater, they had a great big Coke machine. And the thing that was outstanding was the spilled Coke and the thousands of bees that were lapping up the sugarized Coke. But there, we qualified with the .45 caliber Colt. It weighs about 2.5 pounds. And in those days, they wanted you to have a very lean profile. So they had you stand with your arm outstretched so that less of your body was exposed to firing coming back. The problem was that every time you fired that .45, your hand would go up 2 feet, so you had to reorganize yourself for the second shot. In spite of all that, I still managed to fire a sharpshooter, which is between marksman and expert. Found it devastating, but acceptable.
Before long, he'd be firing guns a little bigger than that in the rear-facing gunner's seat of SBD Dauntless Dive Bombers with VMSB 341 in the Pacific. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a video in which Sid explains a dive bombing run and relates the story of when he may have shot down an enemy plane. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with Sid Zimmon, 95 and a half years old, as he likes to say. He lives in Oceanside, California, but he grew up in Rochester, New York and Detroit, Michigan, and he joined the Marine Corps just after graduating high school in 1942. At hometownheroesradio.com, you can link to Sid's Memoirs of a World War II Marine Dive Bomber Gunner, written with the help of Dr. Linda Dudick, a history professor for 35 years who retired from that role to focus exclusively on helping World War II veterans preserve their stories in written form. If you were to go online and read Sid's story there, you might be tickled by an anecdote involving an actor that you might remember from the sitcom Family Affair in the 60s or Hardcastle and McCormick in the 80s.
One of the, he was an actor. He was in the group that I was directing, in charge of, herding him around. And here, you know, I'm just barely graduated from boot camp and put me in charge of a bunch of guys, marching them to mess hall and to the other facilities. Brian Keith was an actor, and he was in that group. One day I walked into the room. They had a sloping ceiling, and where the bunks were, double bunks, there were windows. Brian Keith was in one of those bunks, and when I walked in, why he had his shoes on, I don't know, but the sloping ceiling above the cot was black, and since I felt the responsibility, I had him immediately scrub it down and make it acceptable.
Because he was scraping his shoes against it?
Yeah.
Well, and he wouldn't be the only celebrity that you would serve with by the time you were done, but as far as that choosing A or G, and you said it was chosen for you, can you spell it out for people who may not follow? What do you think would have happened to you if you had written down G instead of A? How different would your life have been?
There was no question that I would have been assigned to a ground unit, very possibly Guadalcanal, because that was in the works at that time. And radio men carry the radios on the back. And while we're talking about radios, the Navajos were such an overwhelming attribute to the war effort. People don't realize that the communication that they had was so unique. The Japanese would never in 1,000 years figure out what they were talking about. They were just absolutely remarkable and deserve every accolade that you can.
And when I say that, you know, how different would your life have been? It's not like what you did was a picnic or was free from danger, because you saw firsthand what happened to others who were in the very same position as you were. But what about this idea of being a rear-facing gunner in a dive bomber? And maybe people don't understand what that's really like unless they experience it like you did. And I know you've gone around talking to school kids for years and telling them about this. How do you explain what that's like to make a dive bombing run in an SBD when you can't see where you're going?
The training for the pilot to be able to dive, and I'll explain the dive to you, and you can realize that the Marines would dive at an 85 to 90 degree, and maybe a little bit more than that, at a fixed target. We would fly no higher than 15,000 because you would burn more fuel, and we didn't have all the accoutrements, inflatable material that protects the present-day pilot from pressure. The gunners would always face aft. Now, we were radio gunners, but I never once needed or was asked to change a frequency or do anything else. So we always faced aft to protect the pilot. That was our primary being there. When we were at Munda, until the Seabees, bless them, built facilities for us, they cut down the lumber, the trees, and they made literally screened-in facilities for us. It was really very nice. The only thing bad is they made foxholes for us, and washing machine Charlie would come over once in a while, a big Japanese, and the propellers weren't synchronized, so it would thump, thump, thump type of thing. So when washing machine Charlie came over, we would go out, and because the foxhole had about a foot of water in there, all of us were standing around the foxhole. And I remember one time I sat down on my helmet, and when I woke up, everyone else had disappeared. And I know I was embarrassed, even though I was all by myself, but picked up my helmet and carefully walked in, went back to bed.
And what about your time in the SBDs? One of the things that stood out to me in reading your memoirs was you described the very first time you're with your pilot, Ack-Ack Black, was that his name?
A.A., Albert Alfred Black, they called him Ack-Ack.
That the very first time when he started his dive, that you recited something. I don't know if all the other gunners were reciting, and this goes back to your Jewish roots.
It's interesting that you remember that. The expression is, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Didn't go into a big, long tirade, but I figured I should say something. If that's going to help me, why not? So getting back to the actual dive, we would, as we approach the target, it's imperative that you orient your dive. So when you pull out, you're heading for home. If you make a mistake and go inland, you have to turn around and expose to a lot of fire. Whether you make it or not is questionable. So at 12,000 feet, from 15,000 feet, we would pick up speed, orient a dive, and the pilot, as he pushed over into the dive, he would very quickly, and this is why it took almost a year to train dive bomber pilots, because this is not something you have to think about or write down, shall I do this or this or this? It has to be automatic. And so the pilot is a busy, busy guy. We're looking up at the heavens, and he very quickly opens his flaps. Now, the perforated flaps that were designed for the SBD were very, very critical to a dive bomber. And again, I say D-I-V-E, because if you keep your flaps closed, you would go too fast. If you open them, you go too slow. But with the perforations, all the flaps, upper and lower, had 2 or 2.5 inch holes. So by opening those flaps, arming the bomb, the pilot had twin 50s. He would get off a couple of blasts, had it precisely timed what he had to do, because from 12,000 feet at 276 miles an hour, an ideal pullout is 1,500 feet. You could survive at 1,000, but beyond that, there's no hope. You're drumming harps with the angels. And we're pulling about 5 Gs. And to this day, I can still remember vividly, when you pull out of, and this whole process took only 26 seconds. So the pilot was a busy guy. And I remember, as we pulled out, gravity wants to pull a plane down. The pilot, with power, tries to pull up, and so there's vibration. And to this day, I can still remember my cheeks fluttering as we pulled out. Quite a sensation.
Well, you know, people pay big money to go on these roller coasters and feel some of these forces. Have you ever been on one that came anything close to what you felt in that SBD?
Oh, no, no, they wouldn't attempt that. In fact, they would, well, obviously, they would have to go thousands of feet in order to duplicate that. But I do, when I speak to the youngsters at the schools, the high schools and whatnot, I tell them that next time they're on a roller coaster, as you begin to go down, there's a split second where you have zero gravity. You can't even feel the seat, which lasts only half a second. Then, as it picks up speed, the next event occurs when you've hit the bottom and you're just barely starting to go up. you have to overcome gravity, and that's where the force of gravity is the greatest.
And you felt that times 100 in those SBDs and did it time after time after time. And I got the sense from reading your book, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that of all the places that you guys made those dives, the situation that you took the most pride or satisfaction in, or you see as the most significant, was a place that a lot of people, even if they've studied World War II, never hear about, because there wasn't a big land battle there, and that's Rabaul. I imagine that you make a point of educating people about Rabaul when you go and speak.
Yeah, Rabaul, the Germans were there for a number of years. It had a tremendous harbor. There were three active volcanoes. The last one in the late 1900s erupted. It was called the Mother and Two Daughters. I believe that the volcanoes were responsible for making a very, very large harbor, which could accommodate very, very large vessels. Simpson Harbor was the name of it. Now, Rabaul was famous for shipping copra around the world. Copra is dried coconut meat. Now, with all the plantations around, they had a process because a ship carrying a coconut with the shell and the water inside would not be able to be economically feasible. But by opening the coconut and drying the meat, it could be shipped all around the world, which is one of the things that occurred at Rabaul. Now, the Bismarck Archipelago, located just east of New Guinea, the lower tip of New Guinea is Port Moresby, which is the only thing the Australians had control of, and where they built up to seven runways and where the initial attacks occurred. The Japanese, in January of 42, after they had finished with the Philippines and came all the way around China and Indonesia, the Philippines, New Guinea, Papua, stopped at Rabaul. Because Rabaul was so strategically located, it was there for the Japanese to protect all the islands, Gilbert's, Marshall's, Marianas, and the others all the way up to Japan, including Iwo Jima and Okinawa. They had, I've heard, a million personnel there. Many of them they sent down to Guadalcanal, to Bougainville, which was the closest island, 200 miles, the biggest island of the group, and Guadalcanal was at the lower end, and they mostly had their troops stationed on the eastern side, expecting an invasion from that side. But we were smart enough to go on the western side, and at Empress Augusta Bay, around the middle of Bougainville in the Solomon Islands, they built a runway. We were ready to go a lot sooner, but when we finally left in September, we stopped at Upolu, British Samoa. There is American Samoa with Pango Pango, the harbor. Upolu is British Samoa with the harbors Apia. And that's where Robert Louis Stevenson wrote his novel, Rain. It was very, very picturesque, especially before we landed. But, you know, some of these little huts they had there selling whatever food they wanted. There was a skeleton of a ship I heard was a German vessel that sank there. And it was very, very picturesque. I remember, well, as a 19-year-old, Faleolo Field was really very picturesque. And I remember another incident, gasoline initially carried in cans. They were rather large cans, maybe 15 inches high. And what, 10 inches square. One guy, one native, had the can upside down, and two others would be with machetes in each hand, and he would beat out a rhythm, and they were squatting down, cutting the lawn. And it was really something that would be interesting for anyone to see in a picture.
What about what your squadron, in addition to other American forces, what about what you accomplished at Rabaul? When you look back at it now, why is that significant to you? And what were some of the things that you saw and did there?
The fact that it was such a tremendous stronghold and had to be restrained. And MacArthur did want to invade Rabaul, but Nimitz talked him out of it because it had so much armament and five landing fields and others on the northern side of New Britain. Now, the Bismarck Archipelago is comprised of New Britain and New Ireland. They had at the tip of southern tip of New Ireland was a lighthouse. Apparently, it was a radar station, even though radar in those days for the Japanese was pretty new. They could still tell that we were coming. The islands, so much of the time, you see when you look at this flight log, there is so much moisture with the islands surrounded by water that many times you couldn't see your target. And while high-level bombing, you can drop your bomb, but you cannot dive through a cloud. If you can't see your target, you can't dive. And so we would have targets of opportunity. If we saw a hut, we don't know who's in there, and hopefully it wasn't a native, but they didn't dive in the regular fashion. It was just more of a glide on the way back home, but you had to get rid of the bomb because you can't carry the bomb home.
Well, that's for sure. We need to catch another break, but there's much more to come with Sid Zimmon of Oceanside, California. Check out the additional info online at hometownheroesradio.com, including how he finally received the Distinguished Flying Cross more than a half century after World War II. Sid touched on Rabaul, and to help round out that big picture, the decision to pound Rabaul with air power but bypass it in terms of a land battle was really significant. It saved countless lives on the ground. It did cost the lives of hundreds of Marine airmen. Marine aircraft would shoot down over 1,500 Japanese planes there. That includes one that Sid Zimmon fired upon. Check out that video online, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. What a treat today to visit with Sid Zimmon of Oceanside, California. One of the great photos you'll find at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page is Sid in his Marine Corps dress blues with his gloved hands on a machine gun sitting in the back of an SBD Dauntless dive bomber, the very same position from which he experienced some of his most memorable moments in World War II.
An interesting event occurred with the SBD. I don't know about other aircraft, but whenever we would taxi out to the runway, the gunners would always stand up next to the pilot. From the time we left the revetment until we got to the runway, he would start to rev up, and it was in the process of relieving his brakes when we would nonchalantly walk back, jump in, buckle up, and he was already airborne. Conversely, when we landed, no sooner would the tires hit the runway, we still may have been going 80 miles an hour, I don't know, but we, again, unbuckled, jumped out, walked up the little walkway next to the pilot, because the pilot, with the attitude of the plane, couldn't see directly in front of him. And whether there was a plane or a truck or a person or whatever, we could warn him. One of the gunners, a close friend of mine who died at 97 a year or so ago, when he landed, the left tire blew out, and the plane immediately started to turn left and nosed over into the sand. Now, he's standing there next to the pilot, and he's so very fortunate that the propeller stuck in the sand. So while he did literally go through the propeller, fortunately, it wasn't turning.
Well, and there's a freak incident that could have claimed someone's life, but you saw situations that did claim the lives of guys just like you. Can you help us understand some of the potential dangers you were facing by carrying out that duty on all those dives?
You know, when you're young, and fortunately you don't have a wife and children to worry about, there's a difference, you know, when you're concerned about going back to someone, your own family, you might say. Young, foolish, I don't know, committed. There are a lot of things that enter into the picture. Devotion is probably the most significant thing. You know, you're there to do a job, and you're going to do it to the best you possibly can. So you have no regrets after that.
What do you think of as your own personal closest calls, if I can use that term?
I was very, very fortunate. I had a great pilot. You know, at 15,000 feet, well, as a matter of fact, last time I was at Chino giving a talk to the constituents there. The SBD was presented beautifully with the flaps open, perforated flaps, and the bomb. Now, I digress for a moment, but the bomb is attached to the belly on an SBD. Not internally, it's impossible to release it if it's internal. So Heinemann was smart enough to realize that if you attach the bomb to the fuselage of the plane, and when you release it, it's going to go faster than you are, go right through the propeller, because you have flaps and it doesn't. And so they were smart enough to attach, like a wishbone, the front portion would be attached permanently fixed to the fuselage, whereas the two back areas that held the bomb was spring-loaded perhaps, but when released, it would drop just enough to clear the propeller, which I think is a wonderful idea.
Yeah, you see those and you wonder if they learned the hard way or not. But there were, I don't want to get you to talk about anything you're not comfortable talking about, but I know you wrote about this in your memoirs, and there were 406,000 Americans who died serving in World War II. And some of those guys were in your squadron, and they were doing the same job as you. How often do you think about them, and can you tell us some of the things that happened to guys in your position that obviously didn't happen to you?
I wasn't a big mixer. I had a few acquaintances, you might say. Maybe subconsciously, you don't get really close because you realize that this buddy-buddy system is not really healthy in a situation, because if you lose them, you know, then it affects you differently. So I had acquaintances, but none really close, you might say. Not distant, but I had a few. One incident occurred with a guy by name of McLeef, Paul McLeef, on our first flight in January of 44. Now, Pappy Boyington was stationed in the Russell Islands, Vela the Vela, I believe. And while he had a bad reputation of being what they call a drunkard, but he really was an alcoholic, but it didn't interfere. He had such tremendous charisma. The men adored him, and he was extremely, extremely proficient. And he went down. They shot him down. The Japanese shot him down right at the harbor at Rabaul. Most of the prisoners were assigned as slaves of one kind or another, digging deep caves and whatnot. But Pappy Boyington, he had such great charisma that he was able to convince them that he was not going to say one word to these people. He wanted to talk to the hierarchy in Japan and Tokyo. So they accommodated him. And the interpreter that went with him was probably grateful to get the hell out of her. But on our first flight, as we were approaching the target, approaching New Britain, I looked to my right as you scan the horizon and above, and I saw a plane with a tail hanging. I didn't know who it was. Apparently, another plane, because they only lost two, had erroneously, obviously, approached and cut off the tail. It was just hanging by the cables. I didn't know who it was that went down until I got back to the tent, and the tent was on bare ground, slightly sloping, and there were six cots. Mine was the second on the right as you entered. I remember sitting there and looking at that cot, and Paul wasn't there. And that was the first association I had with anyone who suffered demise. And then, of course, the reality set in when two Marines came in and gathered up all the things that he had there and walked out. Then I knew what happened. Linda Dudick, dear Dr. Dudick, apparently, somehow, Paul's sister read my memoir, and she contacted Linda and wanted more information about her brother. And that's when I gave her all the information that I had. As a matter of fact, now, dear Linda, when the Vance Veterans Association of North County meet, she always presents the picture of Paul and talks about him, because his sister was grateful to get the information. And in the city where they live, there is a picture of Paul in his dress blues that's been there in perpetuity.
So he was shot down and captured, but then what happened to him?
I didn't know what happened until I read a book. I heard about a book by Nisi, first generation Japanese, who was so fascinated with Rabaul that he wrote a book called The Siege of Rabaul. Henry Sakaida was the author. And in there, he mentions that Paul and about 25 others, crewmen, maybe some Australians, but certainly Americans, were being transferred from one base to another on the pretext that it was safer, and they were all executed. His pilot died a few months later of dysentery and typhoid and all the other terrible things that happened to them. The Japanese were so atrocious in how they, you know, there was no humanity. They respect someone who died valiantly to the point where in Shichijima, there were eight, and they ate, the guy in charge ate their liver. And in other instances, they eat the heart of someone who was brave and died in combat. But if they died, you know, without direct contact, they had nothing but disdain.
Well, and you mentioned Shichijima and the cannibalism that took place there. And one of the famous stories there was former President George H.W. Bush just avoided that fate because he was picked up just off the coast of Shichijima and rescued. And I'm wondering for you, when you find out what happened to Paul McLeef, is there part of you that says, hey, that could have been me? I could have ended up in that same situation?
It's possible. I may have given a glancing thought, but, you know, you have to go on with what you have, you know, good, bad, or indifferent.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot with regard to, you know, did you imagine yourself in McLeef's fate there? But asking you that question makes me wonder, are there other situations that you look back on now, now that you're 95 and a half years old? Do you ever look back at some of those days during World War II and say, boy, I don't know how I made it through that, or I was really fortunate to survive that day in particular?
An incident occurred with a replacement squadron. Now, after being there for 9 months, three tours, in about September or maybe August, a replacement group came because the squadron had two groups. We were in the initial one, and as a matter of fact, Jerry Coleman, the voice of the Padres, who passed away recently, he was a pilot in the second group. Now, just to show you that you have to be very fortunate when you put your life in other people's hands, because one of the earliest tragedies occurred, which never should have happened. A replacement pilot and a gunner that I don't think was assigned to him before went out on a gliding mission. Now, gliding has its own problems because the bomb, when you release it, is traveling at the same speed you are. Either you have to pull up quickly or pull to the right or to the left to get away from the concussion. Somewhere here I have a picture that the bomb, I don't understand it, but a big gaping hole in the fuselage went into the gunner, and there was blood dripping out of the tail when they returned. And that's the only funeral we ever attended, because in the SBDs, you just don't come back, you know, in pieces. That was one of the rare tragedies.
So it was a malfunction or what?
Obviously, a pilot error, without any question.
So the pilot unknowingly killed his own gunner.
There is no other explanation for it, that he was just not following the rules of glide bombing, because it never would have happened. The fact that it hit the fuselage on the side means that he did release the bomb and start to turn, but didn't pull up high enough to avoid the bomb coming in through the side, because I thought it had gone through the bottom of the plane. But that picture that I have shows a big gaping hole in the side of the fuselage.
Well, I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you, and I'm sure we could sit here for hours, and I hope people will read your memoirs, because one of the things I appreciated, besides all the detail, I mean, there's an amazing amount of detail on all these topics we've discussed, but there's some pretty good laugh lines in there, too. You've got a sense of humor that I appreciated in reading through that. Is there something that you would say you're most proud of? I can tell you're proud to be a Marine and you wear that globe and anchor. But when you think back over all this time and what you did so many years ago, what is it that you take pride in?
I've had my glitches, a couple of things that, in fact, I have a pacemaker right now. The second one, the first one started to wear out before I did. And this one's supposed to last 11 years, so no, I'm not offering any guarantees. I've been fortunate, but I'm not a craver. I don't keep looking for that lost whatever it is that people try to capture. You know, I live a simple life. I was a poultryman, built my own house on weekends, even though I really wasn't a carpenter. But I am quick to adapt. And when I chose poultry husbandry, when I went to Pierce College in San Fernando Valley, I was looking for a way of life. And fortunately, my wife was good enough to go along with it. I take pride in my children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. You know, so many dysfunctional families, they have to bail them out of jail. They're in trouble. They drink too much. They carouse too much. They're thieves. There are so many bad things. And I'm so grateful that I delighted, whatever I have to leave them, I'm delighted that it'll be put to good use and not, you know, destroyed in bars. And I have no objection to a drink and some of the other things that are entertaining, but to be possessed with being constantly entertained, you know, they're looking for more than they can consume. It's just, that's the way I am, you know, about as simplistic as they make.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story. And you tell your story a lot. You go out and you talk to high school kids who are the same age you were when you went into the Marine Corps in many instances. Why is that important to you, and what's the message that you hope they receive?
World War II was so unique, and the fact that we enjoy the life we have is because of the devotion that we had, and to have helped in creating a... We're losing a lot of it, you know. This constant nagging back and forth is so debilitating. You know, we have to have some unanimity. We have to honestly decide what's good, what's mediocre, what can be done, what should be done. You know, there are a lot of elements involved in living life to its fullest. But if you reach too far, reach too fast, you pay a tremendous price for it. So the fact that I'm a very simple guy, don't require, oh, okay, I have one little tiny one-finger drink at night, maybe just to see, keep me alive, I don't know. And I don't burn my candle at both ends at the same time.
Is there anything else I didn't ask you about that you think people ought to know?
There's a tendency to think that Jewish people have different thoughts about wars and other things. Just to show you, and most people won't believe this, but I have this article about Jewish Americans in World War II. During the course of World War II, 550,000 Jewish men and women served in the armed forces of the United States. Another 1 million Jews served in other Allied forces, 500,000 in the Soviet Army, 100,000 in Polish military, and 30,000 in British Army. Jewish service members accounted for 4.23% of all soldiers in the U.S. Armed Forces. Jews were 3.7% of the U.S. population of 139.9 million in the early 1940s. And about 60% of all Jewish physicians in the United States under 45 years of age served in the military. 60%. 22 Jews attained senior rank in the armed forces. 18 generals, 6 major generals, 12 brigadier generals, 1 vice admiral, 2 rear admirals, and 1 commodore. The total number of Jewish war casualties was 38,338. 11,000 were killed, 7,000 of which occurred in combat. Approximately 26,000 Jewish men and women in uniform received citations for valor and merit. The number of awards totaled 49,315, including 66 Distinguished Service Crosses, 28 Navy Crosses, 41 Distinguished Service Medals, 244 Legion of Merit, 1,434 Silver Stars, 2,047 Distinguished Flying Crosses, 191 Soldier's Medals, 28 Navy and Marine Corps Medals, 4,641 Bronze Star Medals, 13,212 Air Medals, and 14,550 Purple Hearts. 3 Jewish soldiers were awarded the military's highest distinction, the Congressional Medal of Honor, Ben Solomon, Isidore Jackman, and Raymond Zussman. President Franklin D. Roosevelt praised the fighting abilities and service of Jewish men and women. General Douglas MacArthur, in one of his speeches, said, "I am proud to join in saluting the memory of fallen American heroes of Jewish faith at the 50th National Memorial Service conducted by the Jewish War Veterans of the United States, General A. A. Vandegrift, Commandant, U.S. Marine Corps, said, "Americans of Jewish faith in the Marine Corps have served with distinction throughout the prosecution of the war. During the past year, many Jewish fighting men in our armed forces have given their lives in the cause of freedom. With profound sympathy and respect, I join you in paying homage to them at this memorial service."
Well, and you read all those numbers, and you're part of that. You're a recipient of the Air Medal many times over and the Distinguished Flying Cross times two. And I can tell you take great pride in being part of that contribution from the Jewish people. And when you told me about your first dive and you recite that Shema, now that's something that goes back millennia in the Jewish faith. And the whole point was they believed they had somebody on their side who was bigger than who they were fighting against. Did you come to that conclusion, or is that how you feel about it?
Well, we all look for straws to grasp, you know, at dangerous times. You know, while I'm not what a typical religious person is, I live a very simple life, and I don't want to use the phrase, but P.O., too many people try not to be antagonistic, except for my son. We have political dissertations once in a while. But I hope I have contributed more to our society than I've taken from it. I appreciate your coming here and being so astute and listening to my diatribe. I want to congratulate your efforts and the cause you represent, because my main focus, if I can, when I can, is to tell people that there was such a significant contribution to our existence, and to ignore it and to dismiss it, which some people are doing today, is heinous. So, you know, if I can help people understand the sacrifices. The other day when I went to get my frequent shot in the eye, there were a number of women that were there, and I told them I was outnumbered, but I wear a cap with Marine emblem, U.S. Marine Corps, World War II, and on the back, combat gunner with the wings, and got a little, you know, Marines, you know. At one point, I think someone asked a question, and so that got me started. And the most surprising thing of all, I said, "Do you know that they stopped slicing bread in World War II?" Now, people will say, "What the hell is he talking about?" When you stop to think that if a saw blade breaks or something happens in the mechanism, steel was not important to slice bread. It was more important to provide something that was necessary for the war effort. People don't know, so many people don't know, that there is an organization of WASPs. Young women, barely trained to fly, would take these aircraft, barely tested, and fly them from the factories to the airfields so that military personnel don't have to use that service. There were a little over 3,000 total young women. I heard 38 died. Today, there are about 200 left of the total amount. And they just recently, within the last year or two, started a museum, Memorial Museum for the WASPs in Texas. I think people should realize the sacrifices, and people didn't complain. You know, my father, he never held a welder in his hand in his life, but he went to work and he was a welder.
As Sid has so skillfully explained today, so many did so much, a reality that we can simultaneously be grateful for and inspired by. We're out of time today. There are a few more stories from Sid that we couldn't squeeze into our radio time, but they are included in the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for spending this hour with us. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there, the that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.